This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Fans of our guest Eugene Hutz's group, Gogol Bordello, can be pretty passionate.
From Italy to London, to Gogol from Gogol Bordello, my favorite band.
That's a couple of fans from the documentary Gogol Bordello Nonstop, which is now being shown in cities around the country. The band's also featured in a 3D concert film with the Dave Matthews Band and Ben Harper in Relentless 7 called Larger Than Life in 3D, which will be released next week. Gogol Bordello is most often described as a gypsy punk band. Their concerts are wildly energized, mixing gypsy abandon with the driving force of rock. There's a band of musicians on stage with two masked go-go girls who dance around singing and playing washboards and drums. Hutz, the group's frontman, often performs shirtless and always gets sweaty. You may also know Hutz from a memorable acting role as a Ukrainian translator in the movie Everything is Illuminated. Hutz grew up in Ukraine and came to the U.S. with his family as a teenager. I spoke to him in 2007 when the group's most recent album, Super Toronto, was released. Here's the opening song called Ultimate.
If we are here not to do what you and I wanna do and go forever crazy with it, why the hell we are even here? There were never any good old days. They are today, they are tomorrow. It's a stupid thing we say, cursing tomorrow with sorrow. Stand here in a row, looking like a bunch of heroes. I know that deep inside, nothing more but a bunch of zeros. Yeah!
Well, Eugene Hutz, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, your band is described as gypsy punk. If I wanted to convince my friends to come to me with a Gogol Bordello concert, what should I tell them to expect? What are they going to see?
Complete orgasmo hysteria.
Okay. You want to fill that in a little bit? What does the act look and sound like?
Well, I guess, I mean, you can tell them whatever the hell you want to tell them, really, but it's all going to end up in a peak experience of, I guess, emotional kind for them. And show is a show, but this show would never work that well without the music and its foundation, which is gypsy music of my origin. Mm-hmm. And the power of that music is quite known to its fanatics. But for me, it was always obvious that gypsy music can become very much appreciated in subculture, you know, because it was always marginalized and in this world music kind of marketing and all these things that I can't stand, really. You know, it just was basically locked up all these years. When in its spirit, it's basically rock and roll. It's probably the closest thing to rock and roll you can find in the history of music before rock and roll as we know it appears.
Traditional gypsy music, you're saying, is
yes.
Like rock and roll, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's probably the most passionate, the most flamboyant, the most merry and gay music that there was before rock and roll. It's a scientific fact, basically.
Somebody described a Gogol Bordello concert as something like standing next to a 747. And I can say you sing every syllable of every song with your whole body. I mean, you just don't stop moving. Have you always performed that way?
Basically, that's why I'm not a real singer. Because I never learned how to sing just with that one mechanism. And I never really was schooled in any way, really, either. And it all kind of came from just growing up around music that's basically acoustically made by my own family. Well, my father was quite an entertainer, just to give him a guitar and a party, and uh-huh. there you will have it, a prototype of Gogol Bordello. You know, he is still pretty much an entertainer of refugee community where he resides now with my mom in Vermont.
As a kid, did you perform for your parents?
No, not really. I mean, my dad always stole the show. It was not until in a school, I think it was about 6th or 7th grade, there was some school competition, and where, you know when they have these things where school competes against the school mm-hmm. in wit and skits and all these kind of things. Anyhow, we had those things back in the Soviet Union. I wasn't even participating, but our team was losing, and they just decided to throw me out on stage like a last reserve because I was into punk rock and I had green hair and they thought it might do some good. And along with that, I did some improv, and that's how we won, basically. So that was my a first taste of little stage victory, and that's kind of basically from then on I decided that that's a pretty powerful place to be, and that's where it all kind of makes sense for me.
And where was that? Did all this happen? Was this in Kiev?
It was in Kiev. It was in my school. Srednya школа номер 170.
What was it like to wear your hair green then and have that lifestyle? Did you get in trouble?
Well, it was perestroika time. So Gorbachev just came to power, and it was considered to be okay suddenly. So we get away with, in school I didn't get much trouble for it, but I would get beat up on a street a couple times and by other youth organizations that called Lubery and all these pro-Soviet idiotic bodybuilder neo-Nazi kids who would basically pull us in the alley and hit us once in the face and we were done. We didn't take that much effort to put us away back then. We were 15 years old, just one hit on the head.
So when you formed a band, I know that you immigrated to Burlington, Vermont, which is a college town, and there is a music scene there. And
yeah.
You formed a band, and then you came to New York and started playing this, for lack of a better word, fusion of punk and more traditional gypsy music and all the other influences that you have. Were your audiences just American kids who were turned onto this, or were you finding gypsies everywhere?
No, actually, when I first came to Vermont, to the States, I played in basically in hardcore metal bands, and before I formed my own band, and in a band that were much more straightforward punk rock. And the process of getting back into my own, DNA music, it took some years, I tell you. And I also didn't want to do it in a stupid way as some bands do it. I didn't want it to be exploitation of stereotype on any rate. So that had, it was quite a process to find an angle of what it's going to be like. And actually the turning point was for me music of Béla Bartók, of Hungarian composer, who worked with a lot of ethnical music, turning it into his own symphonic avant-garde music. So after getting kind of load of how does he process that information, I was able to step up to it without quoting and without just reusing the tunes, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to pick another song from Super Toronto that listen to and tell us about?
I don't know, American Wedding.
I was thinking American Wedding. Tell me a little bit about this song, then we can hear it.
Well, I've been here for a couple years already, to be exact, 12, and I've gone to some of them, American weddings, and it just was a pretty amazing experience. I mean, I just could not believe that people actually would celebrate or would even call it celebration. And the funny thing is that I wasn't even going to put the song on the album. I literally wrote it to entertain somebody in 10 minutes on an after party. I just polished up some rhymes later on. But the funny thing about it is that it's the Americans who get the biggest kick out of it, because once it was done, they're like, you have to put it on the album. It's everybody can relate to it. It is what it is. I can't believe nobody wrote it before.
And
it's
the
how can we do it like that?
Right.
You know, it just was such a contrast to me, because the wedding in Eastern Europe is 3 days long experience, you know, and just going to conference room rented out till one in the morning, you know, it's like in a hotel is like, ah.
It's lame by contrast. All right, so let's hear the song. This is American Wedding by Gogol Bordello.
American wedding. Where's the vodka? Where's marinated herring? Where's the musicians that got the taste? Where's the supply that's gonna last 3 days? Where's the band that like fanfare? Gonna keep it going 24 hours. Patching up the cards, everybody's full of cake, staring at the floor. Proper couples start to mumble that it's time to go. People gotta get up early if they gotta go.
That's American Wedding by Gogol Bordello and our guest Eugene Hoots. Your life was affected by the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, right? I mean, how close were you to the accident? How did it affect your family?
Well, Kiev is 65 kilometers away from Chernobyl, so as thousands and thousands of other people, it's like, of course, we're affected by it in every way, in mental way and in geographical dislocation way. And you know, I feel always hesitant to talk about it, because there are people who suffered from it much more. I mean, it was close, but you know, we still had our things together enough to listen to BBC radio promptly and receive a message that we need to get out. Other people stayed there for weeks and weeks later on. And, you know, that's how Soviet government was working, you know.
You mean it wasn't the government that had informed you? You picked up a BBC broadcast and knew to hightail it out of there. Right?
Oh, absolutely. There was no official news for 6 days after the thing. There was nothing. I mean, kids kept going to school. And my dad and I, being rock and rollers that we are, you know, always tuning into BBC, listening to music programs in a Russian language, you know, that was basically a forbidden thing to do. And eventually, my dad was busted for that, and it's actually one of the things that helped us to get out. But
your dad was busted for what?
For listening to that, to BBC. He was busted for it several times during his youth. They actually caught him listening to that in the army. And I mean, there is nothing. It's just the cultural programs, just in the Russian language, that were broadcasted from London by this DJ Seva Novgorodtsev. And my dad, as other young kids, you know, at that time, was tuning in into that and just listening to, you know, Rolling Stones.
Right.
And eventually somebody ratted on him that he tunes in into this stuff. And and that the file started, and the file continued for a couple decades till there's so much stuff accumulated that... You know, that he was interrogated a couple times, and we threw a bunch of other stuff together and said, listen, we can't stay here anymore. It's like, what's next? They're going to lock him up, or we got to get out of here.
And that's what led to your family moving to Vermont as political refugees. It wasn't simply fleeing the Chernobyl accident, right?
All of it was like accumulation because once we were left Kyiv because of Chernobyl, it was already like, even when we came back to Kyiv, it wasn't like we were kind of unsettled there. It was like the move was done. We came back, stayed a couple years, and basically those years were spent on making sure we're getting out for good. But the thing about, you know, when we were evacuated, as bizarre as it sounds, that actually led me to a major discovery, you know, for my life, because I was a little kid, and as I said before, I didn't think anything about the fact that, you know, my grandmother is gypsy and, you know, that my uncle is complete fanatic of gypsy music. And when we left and stayed with our relatives, that's where I was actually submerged in a full-on Romani environment for the first time in my life. So after a year of living with them, it had a lot. Maybe because I was so young and impressionable, but I think, you know, your DNA is gonna play part in it too. My identification, like, psychologically changed actually, and it's an important age for anybody, 13, 14, 15 years old, you know. And suddenly I was hanging out with totally different kind of kids who had other things on their mind. And when I lived with them, I experienced different things, that just the feelings that I never had, because the general intelligence and emotional life of gypsies is very different. I mean, everybody talks about like gypsy spirit, and it's kind of became this cliche, but more important thing is gypsy psychology, and it's something that nobody can really describe it, because gypsies wouldn't care to describe it to you, and other people just can't understand it.
Well, I guess I have to ask you to describe it. What do you mean by gypsy psychology?
Well, I don't even know if I could fully describe it, but it's something has to do with immediacy of their perception. You know, it's an interesting thing that in gypsy, for example, something I found out, they had no, there is word for today and akana, and then there is word for the word for tomorrow and for yesterday is the same. It's atasya. You know, and it's like, because that's just not today. In a way, what you see in Gogol Bordello is it's me recreating what I saw when I lived with them. It's our spirit. It's how we survive. It's our rising above the pressures and contradictions of life.
Well, I wanted to play a song from your new record, Super Taranta.
And sure.
The one I was going to play was the third track, Xena Marina. This song really rocks, and I liked it a lot. But then when I got clued into what it's about, it had a whole different feel to me. Tell us about the lyrics and what the song is about.
You know, I mean, it's about sex trafficking, and Ukraine is the central of that. You can actually, it's as obvious as walking through the streets, because even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I would still go back and there would be still tons of hot girls on the streets everywhere you look. That's Ukraine. You know, now you go there and it's like, where did they all go? Where did they all go is that they're all busy working in Dubai and Istanbul and other places where they are all tricked in. And most of these girls, they're actually from rural areas, and they're not educated about anything. They just answer ad about, do you want to be a model? Which is any girl in Ukraine will do in a second.
Well, Eugene Hutz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Eugene Hutz is the frontman for the group Gogol Bordello. The group's in Europe now, but you can see them in some American cities in the documentary Gogol Bordello Nonstop. And they'll be featured in a 3D concert film called Larger Than Life in 3D, which will be released next week. We'll close with a track Hoots was just talking about, the Gogol Bordello song about sex trafficking called Xena Marina. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Xena Marina, Dasha Valentina, Sasha Anastasia, Anna Sofia. Vietas izvirtusi į valas ant eti, not as condition inside you and me. I did not invent it, just in charge of it. Simple businessman with simple practical plan. So do you wanna be a model? Yeah, all you gotta do is show up.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, comedian and actor Ed Helms, is known to TV audiences for his role on the NBC comedy The Office, where he plays the jocular and clueless Andy Bernard. A few years back, he was a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But this year, Helms has been getting laughs on the big screen in the comedy The Hangover, which is just coming out on DVD. It's about four guys who go to Las Vegas for a bachelor party. Three of them wake up to discover their hotel suite trashed, the groom missing, and their memories of the evening blank. Starring with Helms are Bradley Cooper and Zach Galifianakis. I spoke to Ed Helms in June, when The Hangover was released in theaters. In this scene, the three revelers are at breakfast. Helms' character Stu is wondering why he's missing a tooth and can't bear the thought of Jägermeister, the booze they'd been guzzling the night before. The three friends are trying to figure out what happened and where the groom, Doug, is.
I looked everywhere. Gym, casino, front desk, nobody's seen Doug. He's not here.
Okay, all right, let's just track this thing. All right, what's the last thing we remember doing last night?
Well, the first thing was we were on the roof and we were having those shots of Jaeger.
And then we had dinner at the Palm, right?
That's right. And then we played craps at the Hard Rock, and I think Doug was there.
That sounds right. No. He definitely was.
What is this?
Oh, my God. That is my tooth. Why do you have that? What else is in your pockets?
No, this is a good thing. No. Check your pockets. You have anything?
I have an ATM receipt from the Bellagio. 1105 for $800.
What's on your arm? Phil, you were in the hospital last night.
I guess so, yeah.
You okay?
Yeah, Alan, I'm fine.
What the hell is going on?
Ed Helms, welcome to Fresh Air. In the film, you four guys get a overly, extravagantly expensive suite atop Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas and then wake up in the morning remembering nothing, but the scene of the hotel room is just, well, the suite is just hilarious. Do you want to just describe a little bit of what the wreckage that you and your friends awaken to?
Thank you. I love that scene too, and it really is, I think, a production designer's dream come true. It's somewhere the assignment was given out: figure out as many ways as possible to completely mess up and destroy a hotel suite. And the details, if you really pay attention and look around, sort of in the backgrounds of the shots as we wake up that morning, you just see such glorious detail. For example, there is a bowling alley set up with champagne bottles, which cannot end well. There's a card house, miraculously, somehow in this insane party. We managed to erect a very delicate card house. There's just a lot of fun little details.
And you look up and then you see a chicken walking around.
Yeah, of course. Chicken, the universal sign of chaos.
Right,
the
right.
Chicken. Anywhere you see a chicken, it's chaos.
And then, of course, the money. And this is not giving away too much because this is in the trailer. But when Zach Galifianakis goes to the bathroom to relieve himself, first thing he looks up and sees a live man-eating tiger. You actually used a real tiger for these scenes. Is that right? What's it like working with a tiger?
Yes, we used a real tiger, and it is crazy to work with a tiger. I feel like you're just buying time when you're working with a tiger. It's only a matter of time before something horrible happens, and there's a little voice in the back of your head that's just saying, stop doing this. Leave. Get away from the tiger.
Were there any particular instructions you got on working around a tiger?
The first day that we worked with the tigers, we got this whole long safety speech. You know, don't hide behind things because then the tiger will perceive you as prey. Act confident. Act like, you know, don't turn your back on the tiger. Be sure of yourself around the tiger, which is sort of like asking you to fly. It's just like,
right.
You know, and then a lot of sort of just protocol about how the trainers will be handling the tiger, this, that, and the other. Cut to like a half hour later, it was all pretty much out the window. Like everyone just got comfortable. Once the tiger hadn't killed anyone for about a half hour, everyone just got too comfortable. And you had to sort of constantly remind yourself that this is a man-eating creature, and it is a wild animal. So overall, the tiger was exciting, exhilarating, but I still can't shake this feeling that we just got away with something.
You're a dentist in the movie, and when you wake up in the morning, you're missing a tooth. And it looks like you actually stick your tongue into the hole. It looks so real. How do they do that?
Dave, it is completely real. I had an implant when I was a teenager. I lost a tooth, and I had an implant put in. And I hadn't touched it in 20 years. It was perfectly healthy. When we started to kind of try to figure out how to give me a missing tooth, because it was always in the script, we tried a couple of things. We tried to black it out. They made a prosthetic for me that sort of looked like a gap in my teeth, but it actually made the rest of my teeth look like a donkey mouth. So I vetoed that very quickly. And then very reluctantly, I admitted, well, I do actually have an implant here. And Todd was like, oh, great, then we can take it out. And I was like, well, I don't know. And I called my dentist, and he said, you know what? I think we can actually do that. So my dentist, who is a great guy and actually came to the premiere, took it out, and I was toothless there for 3 months while we shot the movie, and then I got a nice new implant.
Wow, you really were made for this role, weren't you? God.
Yep.
Here's a scene from last night's episode where he's called in to talk with his boss, Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell.
You wanted to see me?
Yeah, have a seat.
Is it serious? Wow. Andy's a little scared.
Okay, right there. Right there is the problem. There have been reports around the office that you have been talking baby talk.
Why would people say that?
Well, I have it on good authority that you said the following. Can you read that back to me?
Andy have a boo-boo tummy.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather me say, hey, guys, my irritable bowel syndrome is flaring up.
Okay.
Crazy diarrhea happening right now. Because things can get real adult real fast.
You are also on record as saying, widow idle, footy woodies, num-nums, jammies, make boom-boom, widicowis, and woad iwind.
Do I sometimes replace R's with W's? Do I sometimes repeat a word to get my point across? Well, if I do, Andy saw we.
You can't be a baby in the office. It makes me look like I hire babies.
Well, if we're complaining, a lot of people think your Elvis voice is annoying.
Okay, who said that?
I'm just people. For the record, I think it's pretty fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you a lot. And for what it's worth, I think your baby voice is topped.
Thank you, Mr. Elvis.
You're welcome, baby.
Tell us about this character. He's kind of a hard guy to figure out, Andy Bernard, your guy in the office.
Yeah, he's a bit of an enigma. He's actually pretty simple when you think about it. He's desperate to be liked. He's eager, very eager to impress, a little bit hot-tempered, but ultimately very earnest and eager to love and wants to share himself with other people.
You know, you did a lot of years of stand-up and sketch comedy where you have an audience and the feedback is live and you know what works and what doesn't. I mean, The Office is so different. I mean, A, because you're in a TV studio, you're not in front of an audience, but it's also that the humor is sort of often in these sort of awkward spaces and silences. Is it kind of harder to know when you've nailed it with that kind of a show?
That's funny because nailed it is one of Andy Bernard's sort of trademark right. lines. But, you know, we laugh a lot on that Office set. And usually the shots, the scenes are pretty quick. So even if there's no laughter in an actual take, if it's a great take, people are laughing right afterwards. And a lot of times people are laughing during takes, myself included. I'm pretty bad at ruining a lot of takes. So there is a lot of laughter. And you can tell on the page when the writers have nailed it and all you got to do is say it. There's instantaneous feedback, even on a TV set or a movie set.
The other thing that's interesting about Andy Bernard is that it uses another tool in your kit, which is your music. I mean, you sang a cappella and you play the banjo, and there are various points in the series at which
the two most annoying musical forms on earth.
How did that get into the show more? Was that something they just kind of saw you had, or did you ever improvise just breaking
yeah,
into song?
Yeah, well, one of the great things about The Office set is it's so open to improvisation. You really don't need to very often because the writing is so good. But if you're inspired or want to, it's just an open field and you can kind of mess around. So those first eight episodes, the writers endowed Andy with such funny little traits, one of which was being an a cappella singer and obsessed with a cappella music. It just so happens that I, too, Ed Helms, am kind of obsessed with a cappella music. And so I just sort of massaged that character trait and kept bringing it up. I just inject little pieces of music here and there into my lines in very inappropriate places. And so it became this fun sort of symbiotic feedback loop with the writing staff of I would give Andy some trait and then they would play with that and expand it in some way. And with regards to the banjo, the showrunner, Greg Daniels, was just so tickled that I played the banjo and wanted to stick it in the show. What I love about that is that it doesn't make any sense. My character, Andy Bernard, is a preppy Connecticut yacht club kid. Why on earth would he play the banjo? But it's just one of those fun mysteries about Andy Bernard, I guess.
Right. Don't think about it too much.
Right.
If you're just joining us, our guest is comedian and actor Ed Helms. His new film is The Hangover. You grew up in Atlanta, right? And went to school
yes.
at Oberlin in Ohio? Yeah.
That is correct.
Were you the kid breaking up the class in school? Was comedy always a big part of your life?
Comedy has always been a huge part of my life. I was not particularly funny, I don't think, in school. I wouldn't consider myself a class clown by any means. But comedy just was always something I was obsessed with, comedy television and movies. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, I started watching Saturday Night Live, and it was Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo and Martin Short and all those guys, and I didn't even understand it. It was just an energy that I wanted to be a part of. I really think Eddie Murphy's stuff is what sucked me in. I just really wanted to be a part of that.
And you went to New York after college, right, and started just doing sketch comedy and stand-up. How hard was it to get started, to make a living, to know that you could do this?
You know, it was hard logistically, but I never questioned it. It was always sort of like just what I had to do, and I was so excited to be in what I thought was sort of the center of the comedy universe, and, you know, going to comedy clubs, and there's Jim Gaffigan right there, you know, one of my stand-up sort of heroes, and or there's Dave Attell, and before long, you know, after a few years, I had sort of carved out an actual place for myself in the New York comedy community, and, you know, looking back, they were maybe sort of lean years and a little tough, but it was so fun and such a exhilarating, optimistic time. And the stakes were very low. No agents or movie makers or deal makers were coming to shows. It was just a bunch of really eager young comedians trying to impress each other and support each other.
So there came a point where you got into a tryout and became a regular on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And I mm-hmm. thought we would listen to a cut from one of your field reports. This is about a small town in Texas that changed its name to get a commercial benefit. I don't know if you remember this one. It was the town of Clark. And in this case, you're interviewing Bill Merritt, who is the mayor of this town of Clark, population 125. And I'll just mention for reasons that will be clear in a minute, that it's hundreds of miles from any coast. Let's listen to you interviewing the mayor.
In recent years, rural communities have suffered as residents have left in favor of places that offer things like stimulation or to do. In the North Texas town of Clark, a sleepy backwater with 125 residents, it has become a matter of survival.
When I first moved here, this town was not a place that people were inclined to move to. There were very few positives, and it was pretty sad.
Really? It looks like you did a great job cleaning up after the hurricane.
No hurricanes hit here.
I looked around. It looks like...
No.
Any mayor could mask a town's flagging appeal by courting industry or tourism. But Mayor Bill had a more innovative solution.
I brought everybody who lives here free satellite service for 10 years.
And all the town had to do in return was change its name from Clark to Dish, as in Dish Satellite TV.
You know, this is very progressive. As you're aware, there's very few people and towns out there that have ever done anything like this.
And while NFL Package Wisconsin and Adult On Demand Missouri might take exception to that, it's clear Bill's initiative has revived the town.
And that's our guest, Ed Helms, on a piece from The Daily Show. And this brings up something that I've often wondered about in these field reports, where you're going out and you're doing a comedy piece on somebody who feels very strongly about whatever they're doing. In this case, he's the mayor of a small town. It might be somebody who has an attachment to a fringe political cause or some obscure product they've invented. And you're there really to poke fun at them. And I'm wondering, do you tell them beforehand, look, I'm going to kind of make some fun of you here, or do you just do it and apologize afterwards, or what? How does that go?
Well, first of all, I want to contextualize that clip a little bit, because the mayor of that town actually sold out that town and was a pretty cynical character. So I would always approach those interviews with it wasn't as much about making fun of person as much as trying to kind of expose some hypocrisy somewhere or make myself look stupid. But to answer your question, no. I mean, we would not prep people for the interviews in any way. But that said, a lot of people obviously are familiar with The Daily Show and had some sense of what we might be up for. This particular guy was just happy to get some publicity for his town, so he would have done anything.
Before we let you go, Ed Helms, I wanted to ask you a couple other things. You do voiceover work for commercials, or did do? Do you still do that for? I mean, you did Burger King and Doritos and stuff.
Yeah, I did when I was doing stand up in New York. That's that ultimately became how I supported myself, was just doing voiceovers for TV commercials. And radio commercials.
Do you have a favorite pitch?
You know, I did hundreds of them, and I can't – they just all sort of blurred together.
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of your characters, you are often sounding all-knowing and authoritative, but in a way that's kind of over the top and self-mocking.
And ultimately not knowing of anything.
Right. And I wondered if it's ever tempting when you're selling the Whopper to – yeah, I don't know. Just throw a little irony in there. Like, do you really believe this?
No, Dave. I'm a professional. If I'm recording a commercial voiceover, I try to make it sound like I believe in it, whether or not I do, I guess.
All right. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ed Helms' film The Hangover is out on DVD this month. The new movie Brothers is a remake of a 2004 Danish film by Suzanne Beer. Like the original, it centers on a pair of very different siblings and the ways in which they switch roles when one comes back damaged from war. It's made by the Irish director Jim Sheridan, who made My Left Foot and In America. The film stars Tobey Maguire as a Marine captain from a military family, Natalie Portman as his wife, and Jake Gyllenhaal as his brother. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In Brothers, Tobey Maguire and Jake Gyllenhaal are Sam and Tommy Cahill. Sam is about to be redeployed to Afghanistan to be with his men. That's what he always says, my men. Tommy is his opposite, grizzled, shambling, a drinker. He just got out of prison after 3 years for armed robbery. The movie is called Brothers, but the center, the fulcrum, is the whole Cahill clan. Natalie Portman is Sam's wife, Grace, an ex-cheerleader. She barely stands the sight of Tommy. The extended family features Sam Shepard as the brother's alcoholic dad, who also barely stands the sight of Tommy, Mare Winningham as their patient stepmother, and as Sam's young daughters, Bailey Madison and Taylor Gear, who compete for attention and react to deadbeat Tommy in different ways. When early on Sam's chopper goes down in Afghanistan and word comes back he's dead, the family structure collapses, predictably. What isn't so predictable is how Tommy will react and move in to fill the gap. You certainly can't guess it from how he takes the news, when Grace catches him drunk in the middle of the night, returning keys to his brother's truck.
Grace. You. Look, you know, just say it, you know what I mean? All right, he told me I could borrow the car whenever I want.
Sam's dead.
What are you talking about?
He's dead, Tommy. Come here.
Why didn't you call me? Okay. Why'd you let him go over there, Grace?
Tommy.
For what now, huh?
It's not a spoiler to say top-billed Tobey Maguire does not, in fact, die in the first 15 minutes. But for much of Brothers, he's thought by his family to be dead. Director Jim Sheridan skips among the three protagonists, Sam in Afghanistan and Tommy and Grace back home, but he never loses the story's pulse. That's because the story isn't Sam or Tommy or Grace individually, but the family unit. It's how Sam's actions, when he's captured, relate to how his dad raised him and what he owes Grace, and how Tommy's assumption of responsibility is partly because Grace is so pretty and her older daughter so needy, and partly to prove something to his dad that he couldn't when Sam was alive. Who'd have guessed the stars who made their names as nerd heroes Peter Parker and Donnie Darko could be so credibly messed up and volatile? Maguire isn't big physically, but his tautness radiates power. Responsibility is his mantra. When he's thrown in a pit with one of his men, he coldly orders the soldier to forget his family, forget everything but his name. But as we jump back to Sam's wife and daughters, we wonder, can he really forget his own? Sheridan has gotten the best performances from his other two leads of their lives. Gyllenhaal's Tommy turns out to be as tightly wound as his brother. Only too scared to focus, he looks pitifully vulnerable as he begins to take on his brother's role. Natalie Portman has the kind of part that turns actresses into dullards, the wife who looks stricken while her man rages. But she's so grounded, so in the moment, that as others carry on, your eyes keep drifting to her. Sheridan pulls you in so deep, so fast, there isn't time for the alarm to go off that says, "Warning, another traumatized vet movie." It is that, ultimately, but it doesn't stop dead for McGuire to emote. The cross-currents keep you scanning the frame to watch the subtly vibrating face of Shepard, who's never been better, or the two wonderful girls. Up-and-coming English actress Carrie Mulligan has a small role, and I liked her better than in her showier turn in the film An Education, where she has to exaggerate her character's naivete. Actors in Sheridan's movies are fully engaged, thinking hard in character, and you feel as if you're inside their heads. For this great director, empathy seems to come as naturally as breathing.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.